So what I want to do over the next three Sunday mornings, and I appreciate everybody. I know every day is like the other day, but I still appreciate that everybody comes on a Sunday morning. What I want to look at is I want to look at Jewish literature in the Second Temple period. And it's really an interesting topic because when we think about Jewish literature, we think about the Torah, the Tanakh, which was written during the First Temple period, the Chumash, and then the Nevi'im, and then the Ketuvim. And then we think about Second Temple, about post-Temple literature. That's really the Gemara, as we have it, written in Palestine and then written in Babylon. But it's amazing when you think about it, that during the Second Temple period, that's really from around the year 550 BCE until the temple is destroyed in 70, and then around the year 150, there is no Jewish literature, or there's very, very little Jewish literature. And what I want to do over the next three weekends is I want to look at three examples of Jewish literature from during this period. The first we're going to look at today is what they call the Apocrypha. Then next week we'll look at Josephus. And then the third week we'll look at the beginning of the Mishnah, which also the beginning of the Mishnah took place during this period. Let's start with the Apocrypha. What is the Apocrypha? Here's my book, the Apocrypha, which you see backwards, but here's my book, the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is 15 books that were written during the Second Temple period, the period they call the pre-Christian period, that interestingly Catholics accept as part of their Bible, but it's not accepted by the Jews, it is not accepted by the Protestants. So if you were to go into Barnes & Noble when Barnes & Noble is open, or you would go online and you would look at a Catholic Bible, the Catholic Bible includes these 15 books. The Jewish Bible, what we call the Tanakh, does not include these books. And the Protestant Bible, while there's a disagreement within the Protestants, basically speaking, the Protestant Bible doesn't include this either. Now, what exactly are these books? So, of course, to understand the books that are rejected, we have to understand what makes up the set of rules that establish the Jewish canon. And the word canon, C-A-N-O-N, is really a unique word, at least a word that was established, to describe any set of books, the decision what's in and what's out. And the Jewish canon, the decision of what books were in the Tanakh and what books were rejected from the Tanakh, actually is a very, very interesting story. There are 24 books in Tanakh. And the stories of Tanakh take us from the day of creation, however you understand that, to more or less the time of the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. We know the stories of Esther, the stories of Daniel. We know those are the stories that are the end chronologically of the stories of the Tanakh. So you get the impression that the Tanakh was codified, that the canon was established, that the decision was made which books to include in the canon and which books to reject sometime after the destruction of the first temple, or maybe at the time of the beginning of the building of the second temple. But actually, it's not true. Probably, and this is an amazing fact in itself, probably during the time of the Second Temple, that's 500 years, from around the year 500 BCE to the year 70 CE when the temple is destroyed, over 500 years, probably there was no set rule about what books were included in the Jewish canon and what books were rejected from the Jewish canon. It almost didn't make any difference because the Jews had their books. And some communities had this book and some communities had this book. It didn't make any difference. What happened? What happened was one word. What happened was the Christians. What do I mean what happened was the Christians? You see, the minute that the Christians are introduced and they start writing their own books, well, then we have trouble. Then we need to decide, well, which books are accepted and which books are rejected. So actually, and again, this is still something that people are not 100% committed to or that they definitely know, but this is more or less the theory that the decision which books were included in the Tanakh and which books were rejected from the Tanakh was a decision that was made only after the destruction of the Second Temple, around the year 100 or so, when there was a battle about early Christianity, about whether to include the books of early Christianity. And therefore, the rabbis had to make this decision. It's also possible that this decision wasn't made in one full swoop. It wasn't like they had a rabbinic conference and they made the decision, what are the 24 books of the Tanakh? No, this is probably something that was a gradual process, something that took place over time. And that in itself, let's just pause for a second to think about that. That's a pretty amazing thing. Because the fact that there are 24 books in the Tanakh, the fact that this is the Tanakh, this has been the Tanakh as long as we know it, and that the books in this Tanakh are literally the holy books. The fact that that was kind of up for grabs for a couple of hundred years, and the fact that there wasn't necessarily agreement about that, is actually, when you take a deep breath and you think about it, is actually an unbelievable thing, right? So let's think for a minute about, so if it's true that Tanakh as we know it was only established around the year 100. So the first fair question to ask is, what did Tanakh look like before that? During this interim period in which it wasn't quite decided which books were in and which books were out. So what did the Tanakh look like? So actually, in terms of the Tanakh as we have it, we know of three versions of the Tanakh. One is the traditional version, the version that we have now as the official version of the Tanakh. And we have to imagine that this version wasn't created at some later date, that this version always existed. However, there's a second version of the Tanakh, which we have. We have it in Greek, and we have it translated into Hebrew, we have it translated into English. That's something called the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Torah, of the Bible, actually. Now, the Gemara has, as the Gemara often has, a fantastic miracle story. And that is, the Gemara tells us about a king in the 3rd century, that's in the 200s BCE, he was a Greek king by the name of Ptolemy II. And he called on the Jews of Alexandria to translate the Torah for him into Greek because he wanted to learn the Torah. And he put 70 Jews into 70 rooms and a miracle happened. And that is, they all translated the Torah exactly the same. Obviously, that's impossible. Number one, it's impossible because it's impossible. And number two, it's impossible because it's 70 Jews. And there's no way that 70 Jews could possibly agree. And you know, and he has some wonderful examples, the Gemara has some wonderful examples where the rabbis, not only did they all translate it the same, but they actually made changes in the Torah that all matched the other one. So for instance, Torah begins, Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. You know, if you were a troublemaker, you would say Bereshit bara Elohim, that there was an entity by the name of Bereshit that created God. That's not a good thing. So therefore, all 70 of these rabbis, elders, whatever you want to call them, rejiggled it to say, instead of Bereshit bara Elohim, they said Elohim bara Bereshit. God created in the beginning. That little switch removes that possible doubt. My favorite is always the fact that the Torah in Shemini, a couple of weeks ago, lists the non-kosher animals. One of the non-kosher animals that's listed is the Arnevet, which means the rabbit. However, there was a problem because Ptolemy's wife's name was Arnett, or so the Gemara tells us. And that's not nice to say that his wife isn't kosher. So actually all the 70 rabbis changed Arnevet to Tzirat Raglayim, to the animal with the small legs. Again, kind of a play on the fact that they were protecting the Torah. Now, while that legend is a fantastic legend, and you know, legends are often more fun than the truth is that actually the Torah in Alexandria was not translated into Greek by the king. It actually was translated into Greek by the Jews of Alexandria. You'll excuse me, but the Septuagint was probably the first art scroll translation of the Torah. Or if you like Hertz, you can like Hertz. Or if you like Koren, you can like Koren. I don't care which translation you choose. It was the first vernacular translation of the Torah as we have it. Because the Jews in Alexandria, not unlike the Jews in many, many countries in which we don't speak Hebrew, they didn't know the Torah. So they needed the Torah to be translated into the vernacular so basically they could study the Torah and they could follow the Torah in shul on Shabbos morning. So they translated the Torah into Greek. But of course, that's not such a sexy story. So to make the story a little sexier, they made it that the king wanted it to be translated and there was a miracle and all those kinds of things. But the truth of the matter is that there was a version of the Torah that was translated that was translated in Alexandria in the third century. And there are certain changes, differences between the Greek Torah, between the Septuagint and our Torah. I'll just give you one example, a famous example. In the Haggadah, we say, Chachamahu Omer, with the smart son, what does he ask? He says, Ma'idos ve'achukim v'amishpatim, what are the rules, asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu etchem, that God has commanded, etchem means you. And actually, that's interesting, because the Haggadah, as we know, when it criticizes the Rasha, it says the Rasha, he's a bad guy, because he says, Mahavodah zos lachem, to you. The truth is that the Chacham also says, etchem, to you. Why is the Chacham any better than the Rasha, or the Rasha any worse than the Chacham? The Rasha says lachem, and the Chacham says etchem. But if you look in the Septuagint has a slight variation in the pasuk that the Haggadah uses for the Chacham. Mahaidot v'achukim v'amishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu, not etchem to you, but otanu to us. And which is amazing, actually. What that means is that there might have been a version of the Torah in the third century upon which the Haggadah is based that actually said for the Chacham otanu, includes himself, that God commanded us. But just as an example, that there were differences, not many, but there were differences between the Septuagint and the Torah as we have it. Now, there's a third version of the Torah. That's the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls we know are fragments. It's not the whole Torah like we have the Septuagint. They were found in the first century BCE in Qumran. And basically, they were the texts of the Torah of a sectarian group. What does sectarian mean? Sectarian is just a fancy word for a breakaway. It was a breakaway shul. So we understand how breakaway shuls work, right? The main shul was in Jerusalem. It was the temple. And they broke away. Now, where do you go? When you're a breakaway shul, so you can go next door and you can have a breakaway shul. But when you break away from the temple, you need to actually break away from the temple. So they actually went to the Judean desert and they created their own community. And we have fragments of their Torah. Not complete Torah, but we have enough fragments that we can know something. I'll give you another example. Famously in Ashrei. Ashrei Yoshev Beitecho, Jaluch HaSela, Tehillah LeDavid, Arumimcho Elohai HaMelech. Everyone knows that Ashrei is so famous because it's the acrostic. It has the alphabet, Aleph to Tav. Missing one letter. You don't have to necessarily unmute yourself. I know you know all know the answer. What letter is missing? The answer is that the nun is missing. And our Gemara tells us that nun is missing. Bin foloi becha al tismach, that you shouldn't be happy when your enemies fall. But that actually is an explanation after the fact. Because if you look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls have a pasuk for Nun. Nun is there, which is amazing. So I don't know what happened to Nun in our version, but you see that there was another version of the Torah, which was the Dead Sea Scrolls. So you have three different versions of the Torah. The traditional version as we have it, you have the Septuagint, and then you have the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, exactly what the relationship between these three versions is not so simple. One theory is, actually there are two different theories. One theory is that the Tanakh as we had it has always been the official version, right? That basically even during this period of the Second Temple, when there was a question about what books would be included and what books wouldn't be included, but the books that we had were these books. And the Septuagint and the Dead Sea Scrolls were probably what we would call an early version of a medrash, of a rabbinic explanation of the Torah. There was the Torah, and then there was a rabbinic explanation. So the fact that the Dead Sea Scrolls have a pasuk for Nun doesn't mean that Nun is part of the original Torah. All it means is that Nun, that when the rabbis began, or whomever they were, the elders began to discuss the Torah, they suggested a possible pasuk for Nun. So that's one possibility, that the Torah always was, and this was an explanation. But there is another theory, and there's no way we'll ever know which is the right theory. And that is, you know what? And this is an amazing thing, that during the time of the Second Temple, there were different versions of the Torah that were going around. And different communities of the Torah read different kinds of things. And some read the Torahs we have, and some read the Septuagint, and some read, you know, what became the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the Septuagint included within it these 15 books that are called the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha means hidden or secret. The Christian Bible, as it was translated eventually into Latin, translated the Septuagint. That, by the way, is a proof to the fact that the Septuagint was actually a viable version of the Bible. They translated the Septuagint into Greek. And therefore, because they translated the Septuagint, and because the Septuagint included the 15 books of the Apocrypha, therefore the Apocrypha are included in the Christian Bible. The Jewish Bible, which ultimately did not accept the Septuagint, therefore it does not include these books of the Apocrypha. But that only begs the question. The reason it only begs the question is because what are these books of the Apocrypha? You know, sometimes the fact that in the end they weren't accepted, that's just a kind of quirk of history. That's just the way it worked itself out. But during the Second Temple, these 15 books, and some of them are more famous. I'm not going to look at a famous one today. I want to look at the book of Susanna. But some of the books are more famous. The book of Judith, the book of the Maccabees, the book of Enoch. People have heard of some of these books. It's very possible, and this is what we're going to evaluate today, that these books were actually Jewish books. And the reason they were rejected from the Jewish Bible was not because they weren't Jewish books written by Jews about Jews, but they were rejected for another reason. And that's what I want to study together with you today. Basically, I want to do something, you know, it's the time of Zoom. I want to do something that's a little out of the ordinary. I want to study together with you a chapter. It will feel like you're studying a chapter of Chumash, but actually it's going to be a chapter of the Septuagint. It's going to be a chapter of a book from the Apocrypha of Susanna. And I want to evaluate that chapter to see how we feel about that chapter. Is that chapter, we'll be the judge. Should that chapter be part of the Tanakh or should it not be part of the Tanakh? First of all, Susanna, okay? Susanna is, as you will see, just one chapter. It's in the Apocrypha. It's written as an addition to the book of Daniel. There actually are three additions in the Septuagint to the book of Daniel. Daniel, we know, Daniel is kind of a Joseph figure. who lives around the time of the destruction of the first temple, around the year 500, 580 BCE. He's taken by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylonia. He interprets dreams for Nebuchadnezzar, so he's kind of a Joseph figure. Then there's a complicated story where he gets in trouble, where he's thrown into a den of lions. We say that on Yom Kippur. Misha'ana l'Daniel b'gov ha'arayot hu ya'aneinu. He who answered Daniel b'gov ha'arayot in the lion's den, may he answer us. And so Daniel is a famous figure, probably the last book chronologically that's written chronologically in the Torah, in the Tanakh, written about a period in the 500s BC. Daniel has 12 chapters. In the Apocrypha, the book of Susanna is the 13th chapter in the book of Daniel. Let's see what we have here. Here we go, everybody. Here is the Apocrypha, Susanna, chapter 1. And I'll just read it, and you'll see it's kind of an interesting read, and then we'll evaluate it together. There dwelt a man in Babylon called Joachim. And he took a wife whose name was Susanna, the daughter of Chelcias, a very fair woman, and one that feared the Lord. Her parents also were righteous and taught their daughter according to the law of Moses. Now Joachim was a great rich man and had a fair garden joining unto his house. And to him resorted the Jews because he was more honorable than all the others. The same year were appointed two of the ancients of the people to be judges, such as the Lord spake of, that wickedness came from Babylon from ancient judges who seemed to govern the people. See, these are the judges, but they seem to be bad guys. These kept much at Joachim's house, and all that had any suits in law came unto them. Meaning these elders held court, these judges held court in Joachim's house. Now, when the people departed away at noon, Susanna went into her husband's garden to walk. And the two elders saw her going in every day and walking, so that their lust was inflamed toward them. And they perverted their own mind and turned away their eyes, that they might not look unto heaven, nor remember just judgment. And albeit they both were wounded with her love, yet durst not one show another his grief. For they were ashamed to declare their lust that they desired to have to do with her. Yet they watched diligently from day to day to see her. And the one said to the other, let us now go home, for it is dinner time. So when they were gone out, they parted the one from the other, and turned back again, they came to the same place. And after that, they had asked one another the cause. They acknowledged their lust. Then appointed they a time both together, where they might find her alone. And it fell out as they watched a fit time, she went in as before with two maids only. And she was desirous to wash herself in the garden, to take a bath, for it was hot. And there was nobody there save the two elders that had hid themselves and watched her. Then she said to her maids, bring me oil and washing balls, and shut the garden doors that I may wash me. And they did as she bade them, and shut the garden doors, and went out themselves at privy doors to fetch the things that she had commanded them. But they saw not the elders because they were hid. Now when the maids were gone forth, the two elders rose up and ran unto her, saying, behold, the garden doors are shut, that no man can see us. And we are in love with thee, therefore consent unto us, and lie with us. If thou wilt not, we will bear witness against thee, that a young man was with thee, and therefore thou didst send away thy maids from thee. So basically they set her up. They say, either sleep with us, or we'll say you were with a young man. Then Susanna sighed and said, I am straitened on every side. For if I do this thing, it is death unto me. And if I do it not, I cannot escape your hands. It is better for me to fall into your hands and not do it than to sin in the sight of the Lord. With that, Susanna cried with a loud voice, and the two elders cried out against her. Then ran the one and opened the garden door. So when the servants of the house heard the cry in the garden, they rushed in at the privy door to see what was done unto her. But when the elders had declared their matter, the servants were greatly ashamed, for there was never such a report made of Susanna. And it came to pass the next day, when the people were assembled to her husband Joachim, the two elders came also full of mischievous imagination against Susanna to put her to death, and said before the people, send for Susanna, the daughter of Chelcias, Joachim's wife. And so they sent. So she came with her father and mother, her children, and all her kindred. Now Susanna was a very delicate woman and beauteous to behold. And these wicked men commanded to uncover her face, for she was covered, that they might be filled with her beauty. Therefore her friends and all that saw her wept. Then the two elders stood up in the midst of the people and laid their hands upon her head. And she weeping looked up toward heaven, for her heart trusted in the Lord. And the elders said, as we walked in the garden alone, this woman came in with two maids and shut the garden doors and sent the maids away. Then a young man who there was hid came unto her and lay with her. Then we that stood in a corner of the garden, seeing this wickedness, ran unto them. And when we saw them together, the man we could not hold, for he was stronger than we, and opened the door and leapt out. But having taken this woman, we asked who the young man was, but she would not tell us. These things do we testify. Then the assembly believed them as those that were the elders and judges of the people, so they condemned her to death. Then Susanna cried out with a loud voice and said, O everlasting God, thou I knowest the secrets and knowest all things before they be. Thou knowest that they have borne false witness against me, and behold, I must die, whereas I never did such thing as these men have maliciously invented against me. And the Lord heard her voice. Therefore, when she was led to be put to death, the Lord raised up the Holy Spirit of a young youth whose name was Daniel, who cried with a loud voice, I am clear from the blood of this woman. Then all the people turned them toward him and said, what mean these words that thou hast spoken? So he standing in the midst of them said, are ye such fools, ye sons of Israel, that without examination or knowledge of the truth, ye have condemned the daughter of Israel? Return again to the place of judgment, for they have borne false witness against her. Wherefore all the people turned again in haste, and the elders said unto him, come, sit down among us, and show it to us, seeing God hath given thee the honor of an elder. Then said Daniel unto them, put these two aside, one far from another, and I will examine them. So when they were put asunder one from another, he called one of them and said unto him, O thou that art waxen old in wickedness, now thy sins which thou hast committed aforetime are coming to light. For thou hast pronounced false judgment and hast condemned the innocent and hast let the guilty go free, albeit the Lord saith, the innocent and righteous shall thou not slay. Now then, if thou hast seen her, tell me, under what tree sawest thou them companying together? So basically he cross-examines the two guys, and he says, under a mastic tree. And Daniel said, very well, thou hast lied against thine own head. For even now the angel of God has received the sentence of God to cut thee in two. So he put him aside and commanded to bring the other and said unto him, O thou of Chanan and not of Judah, beauty hath deceived thee and lust hath perverted thine heart. Thus have you dealt with the daughters of Israel, and they for fear companied with you. But the daughter of Judah would not abide your wickedness. Now therefore tell me, under what tree did thou take them company together? Who answered, under a holm tree. Then said Daniel unto him, well, thou hast also lied against thine own head, for the angel of God waiteth with the sword to cut thee in two, that he may destroy you. With all the assembly cried out with a loud voice and praised God, who saveth them and trust in him. And they arose against the two elders, for Daniel had convicted them of false witness by their own mouth. And according to the law of Moses, they did unto them in such sort as they maliciously intended to do to their neighbor. And they put them to death, that thus the innocent blood was saved the same day. Therefore, Chelsius and his wife praise God for their daughter, Susanna, with Joachim, her husband, and all the kindred, because there was no dishonesty found in her. From that day forth was Daniel had in great reputation in the sight of the people. So here we have it, the story of Susanna. In three sentences, it's an extremely familiar story. Beautiful woman goes to take a bath. She's lusted after by two elders. The elders set her up. They want to sleep with her. They say, if you don't consent to us, we'll make up a story that you were with some young guy. She stands up for what she believes to be true. And then all of a sudden, then she's put on trial. They're going to put her to death. At the last minute, out of nowhere comes Daniel. Of course, this is his book. Out of nowhere comes Daniel. And Daniel cross-examines them. And he gets them caught up in their cross-examination. What's the cross-up? They can't agree on under what tree she committed adultery. So therefore, they're put to death. And Susanna and her husband live happily ever. When I read this story, so there are a few things that I'm struck by. Number one, I'm struck by the fact that this is totally familiar. If I told you that this was a story somewhere in Navi, unless you're really an expert in Navi, I probably could have fooled you into believing that this actually is a story that appears somewhere in Navi. It sounds very much like the story of Devorah and Yael and Sisera. This idea of beautiful women and trying to be seduced in David and Bathsheba, this is a theme that is super duper familiar to everybody. That's number one, it's familiar. Number two, it's written in a very religious way. I'm not going to go back to it, you'll trust me, or you can Google it yourself. God is mentioned 15 times. There are only 60 verses in this entire book of Susanna. God is mentioned 15 times. And it's a very Jewish story. What do I mean it's a Jewish story? First of all, it has a feel of a Jewish story. But more than that, there are elders, there are judges. And better than all of that, there's actually a law, a Torah law that's involved. Because what happens? Daniel cross-examines them. That's fascinating, by the way. Because cross-examination, as we have it in the story of Daniel, is something actually that you find referred to in the Torah, but actually only elaborated upon in the Gemara. The Gemara is 1,000 years after this, 700 years after this, the Mishnah. And really, this is a story about cross-examination and catching them, contradicting one another, and then being put to death. You literally could not have a more Jewish story than this. There is nothing in this story that's not Jewish. Yeah, it is about temptation and seduction and sex and all of that, but let's be honest, it's not even R-rated, right? So you want to say it's rejected because it's R-rated? The answer is it's not R-rated. Right? There's nothing. I mean, it's about sex in a broad sense, but there's nothing wrong with this story. So the question is, and here's the interesting question. Why didn't it make the cut? Right? That's what you have to ask. Why didn't it make the cut? And it's so easy. The book of Daniel has 12 chapters. To include one additional chapter, which is a nice story, a famous story. We know it's a famous story. Susanna is a topic of art, is a topic of music, is a topic of culture, is a name that's used to this very day, the name Shoshana. Our daughter's name is Shoshana. It's taken basically from the word, from the name Susanna. So what's wrong with it? But I'll tell you, this was not found. Good. We're going to get there. Ilana, your point is very good. Bingo, but I'm not ready for you yet. Okay, so number one, let me tell you, it's not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's not like it was automatically part of the Bible. The Dead Sea Scrolls do not have a fragment from Susanna. That's number one. And it's not mentioned in our traditional texts, any of our traditional texts, as being part of the book of Daniel. even though it would have been very easy to make it part of them. Now, the other interesting thing, which I think is important, and I think we need to think about that a little bit, is the fact that we do not have this book in Hebrew. We only know it from the Greek. No, it's not non-Jewish elders. Those two elders were Jews. We only know it from the Greek. Now, that's always tricky. You know, on one hand, what that means is that they didn't have a Hebrew version, so it didn't get included in our Tanakh because it wasn't written in Hebrew. It almost was a technicality. It wasn't written in Hebrew. Since it wasn't written in Hebrew, it never became part of Tanakh. But of course, that argument is a weak argument because it's very possible that the reason that it wasn't included in Tanakh, sorry, the reason that we don't have it in Hebrew is because it wasn't included in Tanakh. Had it been that there was a Hebrew version originally, but once it wasn't included in Tanakh, the Hebrew version disappeared. So the fact that we don't have a Hebrew version, that's always tricky. That not having something is not always a proof, because it's possible 2,000 years ago that these things could have been lost. But now I want to discuss. So here you go. Why is it that this book didn't make the cut? So first, Ilana Kelman made a very interesting point. Here's for all the Gemara learners among us. The Torah talks about two types of witnesses that are rejected. One type of witness is something called contradictory witnesses. That's what we have here. Witnesses, I say was under an elm tree, you say was under an oak tree. The Torah says if you have contradictory witnesses, that the witnesses are not punished. I don't know who's lying, right? You just throw out the witnesses, you tell them to go home, and the guy is innocent. There's another set of witnesses, which is something called Hazama, Edim Zomanim. That's a very technical case referred to in the Chumash, explained by the Mishnah and the Gemara, in which I say that I saw you kill X on 74th Street and West End Avenue on May 1st, 2012. And then two other witnesses come and say, I don't know whether he killed him at that time on 74th Street and West End Avenue, but I can tell you one thing, you didn't see it because you were in Central Park at that time and I was with you in Central Park at that time. Now that's a very specific type of lie. And in that case, the Gemara says, Vasitem lo kasher zamam. You punish the witnesses who lied, they get the punishment that they try to give to the other guy. So if I try to get the guy killed because I said he committed murder on 74th Street and West End Avenue, I get killed. That's a very specific law in the Torah. It's kind of it's an odd law. The Gemara says that it doesn't even really make any sense, but that's the Torah says. So the first argument made by Ilana Kelman and made by many people in the past, I don't know, 50 years, 100 years, is that the reason that this story doesn't make it into Tanakh is because it contradicts rabbinic law. Meaning, in this case, the contradictory witnesses are put to death. The rabbis didn't want to put a story into the Tanakh that contradicted rabbinic law, makes the rabbis look bad. So somebody just sent me a note that said, what about Ezekiel? The description of the third temple, the time of Ezekiel, has nothing, has no comparison to what we have in the Torah. And there are laws like in next week's Parsha, who the Kohanim are allowed to marry, in which Ezekiel is different than the laws in the Torah. That is very true. I can't answer that question. I mean, your question is better than any answer I'm going to give. But in the case of Susanna, I can explain it. And that is, I mean, in a weird way, it makes total sense. The weird way is that the rabbis did not want to include a story that had a law that contradicted rabbinic law. You may think it's a detail, what difference does it make? But the rabbis were super sensitive because the rabbis were fighting a battle. The battle in the first century CE was to have rabbinic law accepted. And therefore, they were very, very, very sensitive to make sure that all of the texts the canonized text that we had agreed with their law. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that it projects the elders in a bad way. And it's possible, let's see what Mark asked me, which came first, selecting Tanakh or the Gemara? Selecting Tanakh came first, no question about it. That's good. And that, Mark, that makes your question better. You can unmute. It makes your question better because you see, once the Talmud's written, the rabbis had won. But before the Talmud is written, so it's a debate. And they want to defend their position. Yeah, what do you want to ask? Sorry.
Yeah, but how could the rabbis decide that this wasn't supporting the law they wanted to enforce if they hadn't had the Gemara yet?
Good. So the answer is they knew what law they wanted to enforce. They just hadn't quite put it down yet. They were still fighting to enforce that law. It was that interim period. It's like, you know, when they were, when they were putting together, when Thomas Jefferson was writing the Constitution. That was an important time. Once it's written, it's done. But beforehand, you have to fight for it. So it's possible that they portray the Zakenim, the elders, in a negative light. Now, that also doesn't satisfy me, because this is not the only story in which the Zakenim are portrayed in a negative light. So to say that the reason it's not included is because the Zakenim are portrayed in a negative light, I would say, again, I don't think that's a good enough reason to reject this story. So we have two possibilities. One is it goes against the rabbinic idea of witnesses, of punishing witnesses. The second is that it's not a kind of nice story for the Jews. It's not the kind of story you'd read to your kids about the Jews, because it makes the elders look bad. And again, either one of those could be possibilities. I'm going to conclude with something that's not so exciting, but actually is the truth. I think the answer is, and this is actually, to me at least, what's fascinating, there actually is no reason why this story couldn't be part of the Tanakh. There is absolutely no reason why this story could not be part of the Book of Daniel. It would have fit in perfectly. Had we included it, it definitely would have become the most famous part of the Book of Daniel. And we would have studied it, and we would have known it, and the kids would have known it in school. For whatever reason, it didn't make the cut. Probably the reason it didn't make the cut is because somehow in those days, nothing was written. It was all an oral tradition. Somehow this story didn't make the cut in that oral tradition. Maybe because it was anti-Zakenim, anti-elders. Maybe because they didn't like the law. Maybe because it was a little too sexual, they didn't like it. The answer is that we don't really know, and I think that's what makes it more interesting. You know, if I could tell you, bingo, this is what was wrong with the story of Susanna, that's okay, and that would be an okay class. But I think what's amazing is I can't do that. And what all I can tell you is that the creation of the Tanakh as we know it was a human creation, and that to me is the most interesting thing of all. We think of the Tanakh, rightly so. The Chumash was dictated by God to Moshe Rabbeinu. The rest of Tanakh, the Nevi'im, the Ksuvim, were written somehow with divine inspiration, whatever exactly that means. But the decision what to include in the Tanakh and what to reject from the Tanakh was not a God-driven decision. That was a man-driven decision. And that was decided by people. And we could try to give explanations about why people decided that this story of Susanna shouldn't be included. And that's okay. And maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong. But the clincher of the whole thing is that that's a man-made decision. And that the Tanakh that we have actually is some kind of combination between the divine Tanakh, the books of the Tanakh, and decisions that were made by human beings at a time when they were fighting with Christianity. Maybe they were fighting, Mark, with anti-rabbinic groups. And, you know, they used the Tanakh in order to establish our religion as we had it. Now, once they established the Tanakh, they had tremendous power. That became the canon, that became the rule, and that to this day is the Tanakh as we have it. But it's amazing to go back to that the late Second Temple period and to try to get into the minds of the people and to try to understand what they were thinking and how they made these decisions. Next week, please God, we're going to look at one person, Josephus, a Jewish historian. And we're going to see how Josephus dealt with Jewish history and how he dealt with what we consider today to be Jewish law. So I thank everybody for participating. Have a safe, good week. Rabbi Kelman, what you're doing, the classes are amazing. Everybody make sure to look at the list of classes for this week. They're amazing. And I look forward to seeing everybody next Sunday. Be well and have a good day.
Sorry. Thank you, Rabbi Adam. Really, I'm sorry. My internet went down just as you started, so I couldn't give you a proper introduction. But really, I know you spoke a few weeks ago. Really, I very much enjoy that, and I look forward to next week. And I'll second what you say about the classes we have upcoming during the week. Please do join us tomorrow, Rabbi Liebtag and Dr. Shapiro in the evening, 11 a.m. and 8:30. We look forward to seeing you at many of the classes during the week, and look forward to any of the comments you may have, comments, questions. And thank you, Rabbi Mintz. As you can tell, he's director of 929, the study of Tanakh. That's how he identifies himself, the rabbi of Kehilat Re'im Ahuvim in Manhattan. And we'll see you all next week, and hopefully during the week, everybody be well, be healthy, and have a wonderful day. The weather's nice here in Toronto. I don't know what it's like where you are, but go for a nice walk and enjoy, and